Let's read again in John chapter 10. John chapter 10, and we'll read verses 17 and 18. Therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life, that I might take it again. No man takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father. It's estimated that there have been something between 90 and 100 billion deaths in the history of the world, somewhere between 90 and 100 billion deaths. If it's 100 billion, children, that's a 1 with 11 zeros after it. And one day, we will add our own death to that total. We will increase that number by 1. But of all these billions, tens of billions of deaths, there's one that stands out. There's one that is totally unique. There's one that's completely different to all the others. And we want to look this morning at the uniqueness of Christ's death. What makes it so different to all other deaths? And we want to do that because this unique death leads to unique life and love for God's people. We explore this subject with a view to appreciating more, embracing more, enjoying more the life and the love that flows from this death. And also, of course, we hope that it will attract others who have not yet found an interest in this death, who have not yet brought the life and love of this death into their own lives. And one area of uniqueness is brought before us in these two verses. And yet, as we'll see, there are other verses in the Bible that seem to contradict this verse. And so what we want to do this morning is we want to look, first of all, at the verses which seem to contradict these two verses. We want to do that under the heading of the murderous violence. And then we want to look at what this verse teaches us under the heading the messianic volunteer. And we do that because there are verses that seem to show forth Jesus as a victim, as someone who was passive. And there are other verses like this that seem to show Christ much more as a volunteer. And that's our question this morning. Victim or volunteer? Let's look first of all then at the murderous violence, at a number of texts that present Christ's death as a murder. A murder, of course, is where someone's life is taken from them against their will, taken from them by violence imposed upon them. Their life is taken away from them. And we find a number of verses portraying the death of Christ in this way. I want to read a few of them to you with some commentary. You can either look them up as we go or just listen to them. The first one we find is in Acts chapter 2, verse 23, where the apostle says, Acts 2, 23, Him, that is Jesus, being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken, speaking to the Jews, especially to the Jewish leaders, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. That word slain is a word translated kill in 10 other places in the Bible. So here the apostle is saying, you killed Jesus. Matthew Henry says of this verse, it's probable that some were present here who had cried, crucify him, crucify him, or had been otherwise aiding and abetting in the murder. So here, the apostle points the finger at the crucifiers of Christ and says, you are killers, you are murderers, you did this. Next chapter of Acts, chapter 3, we find in verses 14 and 15 another apostolic accusation. He says, you denied the Holy One and the just, and desired a murderer to be granted unto you, and killed the Prince of Life. Matthew Henry says again, he charges them flatly and plainly with the murder of Jesus. Spurgeon puts it this way, sin is Christicide, not homicide, not suicide, but Christicide. He said, I found many holy men in my books speaking of sins as accursed kill Christs. The name was well deserved. When sin was full blown, it brought forth Christ murder as its chief product. Again, he turns and says, you're murderers. Then, a couple of chapters later, in Acts chapter 5 and verse 30, Acts 5, verse 30, we read, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you slew and hanged on a tree. You slew him. It was your act. It was you who killed him. Another couple of chapters, Acts 7, verse 52. Acts 7, 52. Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted, and they have slain them which showed before of the coming of the Just One, of whom you have been now the betrayers and the murderers? Jameson Fawcett Brown says, their hostility to God's messengers was consummated by the betrayal and murder of Messiah himself. Again, another verse saying, you did this. This was your deed. Presenting Christ as a victim of murderers. And there are a few other verses too, but I hope you're getting the sense here that in a number of places in the Bible, Christ's death is presented as a murder. Christ is a victim. We're being pointed to murderous violence. And it's interesting too, one of the common themes in Spurgeon's writings is that we shouldn't be sitting here saying, that's terrible. They should never have done that. Tut, tut, these terrible murderers. Looking down on them as some kind of holier than thou. No, Spurgeon says, they were but our representatives. They did what we would have done too in their position. But let's look secondly at this verse, which seems to present another side of the picture, doesn't it? John chapter 10. Bear in mind all these, your murderers. Christ's a victim. And then Jesus says here in John chapter 10, verse 17, I lay down my life that I might take it again. No man takes it from me. But I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. You see the seeming contradiction? Notice that little word, seeming contradiction. All contradictions in the Bible are but seeming contradictions. There are no true contradictions. How can we resolve this? How can we put this together? Is the apostle wrong in presenting Christ as a victim, or is Christ wrong in presenting Christ himself as a volunteer? Or are we wrong in our understanding? Well, of course, we know the answer. It's we who have to work this out. Christ isn't wrong, the apostle isn't wrong, but how can we put this together? Well, I want you to notice this morning, this was a murder, but it was a murder with four significant differences to any other murder. It was a murder with four great differences that are brought out in these verses. And the first one is consent. Consent. If you think of an ordinary murder, if I can speak in these terms, to separate it from Christ's murder, if you think of the kind of murders that we read about in our papers or on the net every day, they are all the same in this sense. They were all committed against the will of the victim. If you were to be present at a murder, God forbid, but if you were to be present, or if you were to be even a victim, you would see in all of these terrible, tragic situations, somebody struggling for their life. They're fighting to keep their life. They're fighting to stop their life being taken from them. They're wrestling with all their might to hold on to what is most precious to them. As their life is being taken away from them, they're holding onto it with their fingernails. They're letting it go with the greatest reluctance. It is against their will. It is against their consent. They do not agree to it. They fight it with all their might. And therefore, when we come to these verses and we read, "No man takes my life from me." What Jesus is saying is this: no man takes my life from me against my will. No man takes my life from me against my will. In other words, he's saying, you think that your will is the dominant will here, but it's actually mine. I consent to you taking my life from me. And you could not take my life from me apart from my consent, apart from my agreement, apart from my willing it to be so. You see how different that is to viewing Christ's death as an ordinary murder? This killing was done with his full consent and will. There wasn't one ounce, one millimeter of his will. If you were to take Christ's will and to examine it, to explore it, if it was possible, under a microscope, every single spot, every atom of that will, you would find this word, willing, willing, consent, consent. No place anywhere in that whole time could you find, "Don't do it. I don't want this. I disagree." No. He did this with his full consent. Maybe, children, you can understand this too if I give you an illustration. I'm sure some of you have little dogs. And sometimes maybe you've got a little toy like a rubber ring or something like that. And you hold it in your hand and your little dog comes along and he latches onto it with his teeth. And he starts trying to pull it off you. And you're kind of playing with him. But you don't want to sort of discourage him so that he gives up. You want to keep going. And so you let it go a little bit. And then a little bit more. And he thinks he's taking it from you. He thinks he's winning. Until eventually you decide to let it go. And he runs away, the champion, the winner. I beat him. In exactly the same way, Christ handled his murderers. They thought they were the winners. They thought they were the champions. They thought they took his life from him. But all the time, it was in his own power, in his own will, so that he could truly say, "No man takes my life from me. I lay it down of myself." Consent. No more willing death, no more voluntary death in all the history of death. Second difference is control. Control. And this is a theme that we find in many places in Christ's ministry. He emphasizes again and again that he is in control, that he is in charge. For example, in Luke chapter 4, verse 29 to 30, they rose up and thrust him out of the city, led him to the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong, but he, passing through the midst of them, went his way. In John 7, verse 30, they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him because his hour, was not yet come. John 8, 59, they took up stones to cast at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Jesus' words in this trial, "You could have no power at all against me except it were given thee from above." So you see, again and again, Jesus is emphasizing in his life, he's in control. He's in charge. He's the sovereign. Think back to somebody being murdered. You could imagine that eventually, as someone is being killed, that eventually they do give up trying to fight it. They do consent eventually. They give up. They see it's hopeless. They're gone. But even where there is that consent, they are no longer in control, are they? They've handed over control to their killers. The killers are sovereign. The killers are powerful. That's not the case in this death. Christ was in the position of power and control the whole way through, not just in his trial, but as they were nailing him to the cross, and not just there, but as they raised the cross, and not just there, but throughout the whole passion narrative. He was in total control. Again, that's what he means when he says here, "I lay down my life that I might take it again. No man takes it from me. I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again." Christ was in control of his own life and of the lives of his murderers throughout the whole process. His killers could only do what he permitted them to do. In that sense, his death was not something done to him, but something done by him. Wasn't an experience that he passed through so much as something that he accomplished, something that he did. George Smeaton says this: "He was exempt from the malice and power of men, except insofar as he chose to surrender himself to them." Here's a quote from Pink, which is wonderful. "We must never give a place to the dishonoring thought that the Lord Jesus was powerless to prevent his sufferings, that when he endured such indignation and cruel treatment at the hands of his enemies, it was because he was unable to avoid them. Nothing could be further from the truth. Without his own consent, none could have harmed a hair of his head. The Savior did not succumb to death through weakness, but gave up his life in the full vigor of his strength." Listen to this beautiful sentence. It was not the nails, but the strength of his love to the Father and to his elect, which held him to the cross. It's not the nails. It was his love. I love this quote from Augustine. He gave up his life because he willed it, when he willed it, and as he willed it. Doesn't that encapsulate these verses so well? I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again. That power was not reduced in any way throughout this whole process. Let's look at the third difference, and it's the word command. Notice what Jesus says here. He says in verse 18 at the end, "This commandment have I received of my Father." He's been saying, I lay it down, I'll take it up again. This commandment I've received of my Father. This was a death that was commanded. And sometimes when we hear the word commandment, we think of a position of inferiority. The one doing the commanding is superior, the one doing the obeying is inferior. And that's often the case, say, in a parent-child relationship. The parent commands and the child obeys. The parent is the superior, the child is the inferior, the parent's in the position of strength, the child's in the position of weakness. And so we might read these words, this command I've received of my Father, and again think of some sort of superior-inferior relationship. But in this verse, that's not what's being brought forward, because the difference is that this command was based on a covenant. This command was based on a previous agreement. The Son and the Father agreed that this would be how sinners would be saved. They came together and discussed, covenanted, agreed, planned redemption and the roles of each person of the Godhead in it. And they did that as equal partners. And one of the agreements they came to as equal partners was that the Father would hand the Son over to death, and the Son would be willing to die. The covenant led to the command. The agreement between equals came to be manifested in this commandment and obedience. Maybe think of it like this. You're walking along Lake Michigan one day, and you see someone drowning. You hear them crying. And you're there with a friend as you're walking along the sand, and you see a boat there at the side, and you say, "Well, what can we do?" And you very quickly you talk and you say, "Well, you get in the boat. I'll push us off, and then I'll jump in." And then you maybe say, "Okay, well, and once you get out there, I'll jump in, and I'll try and save the person." And then you row back, and very quickly a plan is formed. They go out to Lake Michigan, they row out, and then the person rowing says to the other person in the boat, "Jump in now, go and get him." And it sounds like a command, but it's not a command. In the ordinary sense of superior inferior, it's based on an agreement that they made as equals on the shore of Lake Michigan. This would be how it would work out. And of course, God's plan didn't take place in a panic, in a rush. It was thought through carefully, calmly, with the glory of God as the ultimate aim. Again, this is what makes Christ's death so different. The Father gave him a commandment to do what Christ wanted to do. He wanted to do it. And so when he says, "This commandment I've received of my Father," it's not, "Oh no, I've got to obey this command." Not at all. It's, "Yes, I now get to do this that we have previously agreed upon and planned. This commandment, this glorious, this wonderful commandment I've received of my Father." Then look at the fourth difference. Consent, control, command, and consequences. There are unique consequences flowing from this death. How does Christ put it here? He says in verse 17, "Therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life that I might take it again." Therefore does my Father love me. The Father loved Christ perfectly before there was any plan of redemption. It's not like, okay, son, I'll love you if you do this. No. There's perfect love in the Trinity without any plan to save. But what is being said here is, in some way or other, hard, impossible for us to understand, the love of the Father is somehow increased all the more by the Son's obedience, by the Son's agreement to take on this role. This is how George Smeaton puts it. Christ, on account of the fulfillment of this great undertaking, becomes in a new sense the object of the Father's love. And notice this too. Here's another consequence. One consequence is, some strange way, greater love for Christ. And then notice here, in verse 17, "I lay down my life that I might take it again." And it's literally "on the condition that I may take it again." In other words, when the Father and the Son planned this, the Son's agreement to die and the Father's agreement to give the Son to die was only on the condition that the Son would take up his life again through resurrection. Do you see two consequences flow from this? There's greater love, and there's greater life between the Father and the Son. But that's not all. There's greater love and greater life for the sheep. If you read the context of this passage, it's all about the good shepherd laying down his life for the sheep. And he's saying here, my death is unique because no death has ever produced more life. Life abundantly, he speaks about it here. I am come that they might have life, that they might have it more abundantly. And no amount of hatred, as manifested in the murder of Christ, has ever produced so much love, even for the murderers down the road. So Christ's death is unique in these consequences, that no death has produced more life and no amount of hate has produced more love. Here are the benefits that are flowing out. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. What a unique death. A unique death that produces unique life and unique love. And this is the death that you're invited to take as your salvation. This is the death that will make your death different to most other deaths in this world. This is the death that will make your death not just another statistic, not just another one on the calculator and the counter of human mortality. This is the death that, as Jesus says in another place, means you will actually never die. In a very real sense. Oh yes, your body will be in the grave, but you won't be dead. you're a believer, if this death is your life, you will have life forevermore, life more abundantly, life eternally. That's how unique this death is. That's how central this death is. That's how different this death is. That's how pivotal this death is in your life and my life. And for many of you here, this death is indeed central to you. It's everything to you. It's at the core of your whole hope, your life and your death and your afterlife. It's everything to you. Whatever else is going, you have this unique death that's giving you a unique power in your life, a unique change to the way you view the future, the way you view death, the way you view eternity. It's the core of your being. It's everything to you. And you love to hear how about this death. You hear about the unique character of it. And you just think, I'll never tire of this. I'll never get to the bottom. I'll never plumb this depth. But there are some of you here who are circling. It's not at the center of you. It's brought into the center of your life each Lord's Day, but you're circling it. You're observing. You're listening. You're a spectator. You're maybe trying not to hear. Or maybe you're hearing, but you're hearing in a very detached spirit, a very impersonal spirit. You're not trying to connect with this death in any way. It's not something you desire to be at the center of your life. And like many who spectated at the actual time of the crucifixion, you continue to do so like them. They watched Jesus there. You're watching. You're observing. You're spectating. You're analyzing maybe. You're thinking. But you're not believing. You're not pleading with the Lord, Lord, make this central to me. Forgive me for circling for so long. Forgive me for just being a bystander for so long. Forgive me for the temerity of hearing about this and doing nothing about it for so long. Make me one of your sheep. Plant this death in the middle of my being so that I may know this unique life and this unique love forever. Let's pray.